government, the legislature, the executive, judiciary, division of power, the rule of law, common law. What do these terms mean, and what part do they play in a free society? Perhaps the biggest issue in our consideration of freedom potentials is how can we have effective government without surrendering the rights of the people to that government? The centralisation of power has invariably generated corruption which has destroyed whole civilisations. The exercise of undue power corrupts not only those in power, but also those from whom power and responsibility are removed. We shall examine how these problems were dealt with in the history of our society. Where did the basic principles for good government come from? Australia's first European settlers did not find them on the shores of Botany Bay. The Canadians did not find them on the banks of the St. Lawrence or Hudson Bay. New Zealand's first European settlers did not derive them from the Maoris. The knowledge of government and law was brought from England, where it was developed over many centuries. Out of this history have developed some extremely valuable concepts and structures for good government. Firstly, we have a head of state in the form of a monarchy which can make no law at all. We also have a system of parliament which embodies the representatives of the people. This parliament can fashion laws, but it can't enact them without the Crown's consent. And finally, we have an administration which simply applies the decisions made by the Parliament and the Crown. The pioneering work was done by a British king from the 9th century named King Alfred. He was the king who brought order, civilization, and enlightenment to the British people. Alfred lived in an age in which Christianity was almost universally proclaimed. Religion played such an important part in the medieval mind that the development of increased freedom was seen largely in religious terms. The great British historian, Sir Arthur Bryant, describing the achievements of King Alfred, had this to say.
The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, that historical record compiled by monks of the chief events in England since the occupation by the English tribes, was probably written at Alfred's inception. It continued to be kept for more than two centuries after his death, and it is by far the most valuable of sources for the early history of England. No other nation in Western Europe possesses any record of the time to compare with it. Underlying all Alfred's work was his depth of Christian faith. Wisdom, he wrote, is of such a kind that no man of this world can conceive of her as she really is, but each strives according to the measure of his wit to understand her, if he may, for wisdom is of God. In the preface to the collection of laws which he published, he reminded his subjects that while Christ has come into the world to fulfil the law, he bade men be merciful and gentle and do unto others as they would be done by. It was this deeply sincere attempt to model both his life and his reign on his master's that made Alfred's achievements so unforgettable. He not only saved a Christian state by his exertions and its people by his example, but he made it worth saving. His legacy to his country and the world was his conception of what a Christian on the throne could be. Sir Arthur Bryant, in his historical work Set in a Silver Sea, described how Alfred showed mercy to his defeated enemies, a concept unheard of amongst the Danes. But by such means, Alfred brought peace and order to England. Bryant says, Alfred had created two things which were to survive disaster and conquest. A kingdom to which all Englishmen instinctively felt that they belonged, and a native literature to enshrine their culture and tradition. More than any other man, he was the first maker of England. His offspring continued his work. His son Edgar, who was crowned in Bath in 973, established the coronation service which is still used today largely unchanged. Behind this service, which was based on scripture, lay the idea that an anointed king and his people were a partnership under God. During his reign, England's institutions, her systems of taxation, currency and coinage, her local government structures, and her methods of issuing laws and charters were the most advanced in all of Europe. In every shire, at least one town with a marketplace and a mint was established. Here contracts could be witnessed and reliable money coined. England became a nation which was noted for its wealth. 150 years later, Henry II, crowned at Westminster, developed the principle of England's legal system. First, he had to overcome the tyranny of England's feudal barons, whose rough justice was more often than not shaped solely by their own personal interests. Henry established his own court system, which he sent on circuit round the country to sit alongside local courts. His officials took over in matters where local court officials might be tempted to make judgments based on their own self-interests. Henry abolished the corrupt practice whereby the strong and the powerful were in the habit of forcibly seizing property from the weak. He introduced the first system of freehold title deeds under the crown. He also established the practice whereby disputes were judged by 12 free and lawful men in the neighbourhood. This was, of course, the origin of our modern jury system. The system of freehold title deeds was taken out of the hands of local feudal lords and made national so that disputes were now heard in impartial courts and juries. No sheriff was permitted to preside over disputes in his own locality. Henry also established the idea that court judgments in complex issues became precedents which could be used in similar circumstances during later disputes. This was the origin of case law, which still plays a major role in our legal systems today, not only in Britain, but in Canada, Australia and New Zealand as well. At the same time, Henry insisted that precedents were not binding under all circumstances, and that local custom should be observed as closely as possible in court decisions. The law existed for the people, not the people for the law. The law was there to serve the people, not to enslave them. Above all, he established that the administration of justice should be open to the public, and that secret courts of any kind had no place in English law. Thus Henry set in motion an organic system of principles open and accessible to the people, and adaptable to local circumstances without sacrificing justice. This system was so well accepted that it was able to withstand weak or immoral leadership in later periods.
60 years later, the Magna Carta appeared upon the English scene. It was the result of the successors of Henry II, who were not as keen to uphold the law as he had been. The church took the initiative, and through the efforts of Archbishop Stephen Langton, the great document which confirms the rights of the individual was established. Sir Arthur Bryant explains what this means.
Ostensibly a restatement of ancient law and custom, Magna Carta promised that the king should not, without the consent of the Great Council, demand any scutage or aid from his tenants in chief, other than the three regular aids long recognised by feudal custom that the heirs of earls and barons should be admitted to their inheritances on payment of the customary reliefs, that the estates of heirs in ward should not be wasted during their infancy, nor widows robbed of their dowries or forced against their will to marry royal nominees. It laid down that no free man should be imprisoned or dispossessed save by process of law, and the just judgments of his equals, that he should not be taxed or fined unreasonably or to his ruin, that his means of livelihood, including the merchant's stock, the craftsman's tools, and the peasant's wainage, should come and go safely in time of war, and that the foreign mercenaries should be dismissed. It provided for the regular administration of the judicial system. It ordered that the common pleas should be held at Westminster and not follow a perambulating court, that none should be made justices, bailiffs or constables who did not know the law of the land, that sheriffs should not sit in judgment in their own shires, and that two justices with four knights of the shire should hold assizes in every county every quarter, that royal writs should not be sold at exorbitant prices or withheld from those entitled to them. The king had to swear that to none will we sell, and to none will we deny or delay right or justice. In all this, the charter, consisting of more than 60 clauses, was recital of the wrongs suffered by subjects under a tyrannical king. And as men of property, and above all landed property, were the only subjects with rights enforceable in the king's own courts, it confined itself in the main to setting out particulars of the redress granted to them. It was a charter of liberties, and to the medieval mind a liberty was a right to be to the enjoyment of a specific property. It was a freedom to do something with one's own property without interference by the king or any other man. Called Magna Carta because of its length, the charter was not therefore a declaration of general principles, let alone of human rights. Medieval men thought of these only in connection with religion. The charter enunciated no theories. It was nothing if not specific and practical. Yet, though its chief beneficiaries were tenants in chief of the crown, it was a national as well as a feudal document. It made no distinction between Norman and Englishman, and it guaranteed the liberties of small property owners as well as large. 32 of its 61 clauses dealt with the relations of the king and his subjects, and not merely his tenants in chief. We grant, it declared, to all the freemen of our realm, from us and our heirs forever, all the undermentioned liberties to have and to hold them as our heirs from us and our heirs. And it established two precedents of immense significance for the future. One was that when an English king broke the feudal compact and gave his vassals the right, universally recognized by feudal law, to renounce their allegiance, it was not necessary to dissolve the bonds of political society and disintegrate the realm. Magna Carta was a substitute for deposition, a legal expedient to enforce customary law, which left the king on the throne and the sword of civil war undrawn. Government in England, though exercised by the king, was to be rooted in justice and based on law, or it was not to be accepted as government at all. Magna Carta was the first great political act in the history of the nation state, itself an institution of which the English had been the pioneers. As Winston Churchill wrote hundreds of years later, the underlying idea of the sovereignty of law was raised by Magna Carta into a doctrine for the nation state. And when in subsequent ages the state, swollen with its own authority, has attempted to ride roughshod over the rights or liberties of its subjects, it is to this doctrine that appeal has again and again been made, and never as yet without success.
The three pillars of the Westminster system. Perhaps you're wondering what on earth the ancient history you have just seen has to do with events at the end of the 20th century in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, or in Great Britain itself for that matter. Is it simply a matter of historical irrelevancy? Or is there something important for us to learn or recall in material about Alfred or Henry, Stephen Langton or King John, Magna Carta or habeas corpus? Let me just summarise, not the history, but the principles you have seen. One, that because power corrupts, no man can be trusted with too much power. Two, that in consequence, government should be limited and restricted. Three, that apart from decentralizing decision-making, the best way to limit government is to divide and separate its powers. Four, that the major part of an individual's life does not belong to and is no concern of government. Five, that many rights, responsibilities, and liberties do not come from government, but from God. Six, that the law must be available to all members of society, great and small, and not made the exclusive right of the wealthy. Seven, that no government representative, state or local, should in any way be able to benefit materially from the decisions he makes as a representative. Eight, that nobody should be judged guilty until proof is provided. Nine, that there is no freedom without private property through which it can be exercised. 10. That all representatives in a free society should be servants, not masters. Those 10 points, listed in a couple of minutes, took our forebears centuries to discover through painful trial and error. There are still many other nations that yet have to discover them. And it was these principles which the people in Canada, New Zealand, and Australia had the immense advantage of being able to bring with them when our nations began. The key to all this experience was the institution of the Crown, which was changed through trial and error from being a power to itself into the guarantee of the separation of powers, the umpire, if you like, to prevent a reversion to the dictatorship idea. Kings and queens are human, like the rest of us. Obviously, there have been good and bad monarchs. But the office itself is above the individual. For example, just because there are sometimes bad umpires in cricket, it would be ridiculous to abolish the position of umpire itself. The point is worth bearing in mind if you have begun to wonder why there is now such an obvious and orchestrated attack on the Crown. After the War of Independence in the United States, a federation of independent states was established in that country. Canada, New Zealand, and Australia chose a different path. They chose to maintain their links with the Crown. Each of their systems strongly reflects the structures and concepts developed in English political history. In both Canada and Australia, similar ideas about federation developed. In Australia, the states existed long before any central government was formed. Each had its own functioning parliament and its own constitution. Nevertheless, the great principles of English constitutionalism were enshrined in our Commonwealth Parliament. This chart shows that the system developed in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Great Britain is built upon three pillars, each of which comes under the Crown. The first of the three is the legal system. The second is our system of personal sovereignty under a constitutional government. And the third is our parliamentary system. Let's examine each of these in turn. Our legal system was based on a unique type of law. It's different from Napoleonic or Roman law, which formed the legal basis for many other nations. Our legal system is symbolized in three statues which stand on the Royal Inns of Justice in the Strand in London. The first is of Alfred the Great, who is often described as the father of English common law. It was under his reign, over 1100 years ago, that peace and stability were first established and the foundation of our legal system developed. The statue on the right is that of King Solomon, the Old Testament King of Israel. He was noted for his wisdom, which according to the book of Samuel was a gift from God. The statue of Solomon symbolizes the independence and integrity of our judiciary. The figure in the center is the greatest of all, that of Jesus Christ, often referred to scripturally as mediator and advocate. This statue represents the spirit of the law. For there is more to the law than simply churning out statutes, bills, and acts of parliament to be written up in endless volumes for the archives. It might justifiably be argued that today there are far too many laws being enacted. The real purpose of a legal system is to produce both justice and mercy, and for this we are heavily dependent on the spirit of the law. So how does this vital principle work? Well, imagine the case of two people brought before a court on a charge of murder. If one were to simply go by the written law, then all murderers would be treated alike. But in this case, the two murders are quite different. The first has, with cold-blooded premeditation, planned his crime. He ruthlessly murdered his victim and tried to cover his tracks for personal gain or advantage. And there is no mitigating circumstance whatsoever. By contrast, the second, in the heat of the moment, has struck someone, perhaps for a compelling reason. He may have been defending his property or his family, and has struck his opponent too hard. There is no doubt that it is murder. But do both of these cases deserve the same penalty? If we are bound by the book, the written law, they do. But the judge is able to bring into the court a whole realm of intangibles, which is where the spirit of the law comes into force. He can take into account such questions as provocation, of premeditation, and of incitement. He can consider extenuating circumstances. And in the end, the penalty given to the first will be much harsher than that given the second. Obviously, it is not possible to allow for such differences in written law. In other words, a freedom-based system of government must have laws and a system for their administration. But it is possible to have too many laws. The earliest Western view, from Scripture, had it that the law shall be written on the hearts of the people. For such a possibility, the laws needed to be few enough and relevant enough for all the people to be able to understand and know them, in spirit at least. Thus, the English jurist Blackstone, in his Commentaries, in 1765, pointed out that Edward I had confirmed Magna Carta by a statute. Quote, "Whereby the Great Charter is directed to be allowed as the common law. All judgments contrary to it are declared void. Copies of it are ordered to be sent to all cathedral churches and read twice a year to the people." End of quote. Thus, in our legal system, the spirit of the law is as important, or more so, as the written law. It is out of this both mercy and justice are developed. Our traditional common law depends on a number of specific legal conditions. The first of these is that the judiciary, our courts, advocates, and our judges, must be totally separate and independent from political influence. The idea of any politician having any say in our courts is against everything that has been learned in English history, right back to the time of Henry II. Any attempt by politicians to get their favourite judges into the courts is a corruption that undermines our whole legal heritage. Where this has happened, our courts have tended to become politicised, losing their integrity and the respect of the people. The second condition relates to the onus of proof, where the accused is considered innocent until proven guilty. This used to apply universally in our legal system, but applies less and less today. However, in many systems around the world, this principle is not observed at all. If one went to Iran or Iraq or Latin America or even many European countries, one is assumed guilty when charged with an offence and must prove one's innocence. You might be innocent, but without proof, your liberties may be removed until such time as you can prove your case. The principle of innocent until proven guilty comes directly from the Christian teaching that the individual draws his liberties and freedoms from God. They are not derived from the state, and they should not be removed without lawful and proper proof as to guilt. This principle was given added strength in 1604 under the Habeas Corpus Act, Latin for hold the body, which says that you may not be held in prison without proper and lawful proof of guilt. If this is not forthcoming within a short period of time, the accused must be released, no matter how great the circumstantial evidence against him. It is better to let the guilty go free than to penalize the innocent. A further principle is that there should be a minimum of two witnesses in court to confront the accused so that he knew who his accusers were. They should be cross-examined by the accused or his advocate to test their truthfulness. Again, this condition is drawn directly from Scripture. These safeguards are gradually being watered down by a reversion to a type of law now coming through the United Nations, operating through commissions. Canadian and Australian human rights commissions and anti-discrimination commissions are examples. Here, people can be forced to attend hearings at their own expense before any charge of a crime has been laid. Hearings are held in camera or in private. Accusers remain anonymous, and legal representation is denied, so that a proper defence is not allowed. In this way, people can be improperly penalised before charges are properly laid against them, and mischief makers who make false charges against their neighbours are not forced to face cross-examination. So you can see how the principles of our traditional legal system are gradually being eroded. The second pillar is what we broadly call our system of personal sovereignty, which constitutionalism is intended to protect. This aspect of our system acknowledges the fact that there is a sense in which each individual is sovereign over his own life. There is a part of your life which does not belong to the king, or to the state, or to the parliament. Christ put it in these words: "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Hence, the monarch, in the coronation oath, vows to govern in accordance with the laws and customs of the respective peoples. Government, with the consent of the governed, is such a custom of all peoples with British-based law. Thus, if any of the Crown's peoples have their liberty impugned in any way, whether it be in Canada, New Zealand, Britain, or Australia, it is the sworn duty of the monarch to protect them. Obviously, the monarch cannot defend each one of millions of people in person. So there are specific forces in the Crown's service for this function. If, for instance, a nation is attacked, the armed forces are committed to the defence of the nation. The Crown may accept advice from members of Parliament about when and where to act. But the monarch is leader of the armed forces, not the politicians. That is why the armed forces wear the crown on their uniform. They are known as the Royal Australian Navy, the Royal Air Force, the Royal Canadian Mounties, and so on. If our civil liberties are threatened by crime, violence, or disorder, it is the police we depend on to protect us. Traditionally, the police come under the crown, rather than any state or federal politician. The courts, too, are the Queen's courts, free of political interference. And even politicians, once they become ministers, are ministers of the crown. When we hear politicians arguing for the abolition of the crown, they never go so far as to say, who would assume these powers if the crown was to be abolished? It is an insidious argument, like the batsman in cricket who also wants to umpire his own batting performance. All these arrangements were accepted by Australians when their nation was born. They felt it necessary to ensure that the instrumentalities of power, protection and enforcement were kept out of the hands of politicians, and an impartial monarchy was seen as the best way in an imperfect world of checking unlimited power and protecting the citizen. The third pillar stands for our parliamentary system, where the chosen representatives of the people gather to advise the Crown on the desired policies of the people. That, at any rate, was the original concept, now never taught and very seldom observed. The idea of Parliament was never to give a group of politicians license to do whatever they want. They are also required to obey the law and the Constitution, and they must submit to a system of checks and balances. There is an upper and lower house in the federal sphere of government, so that one house can review and, if necessary, check the work of the other. Each house can initiate legislation so that there is a slowing in the process of legislation and administration. The Crown, too, is in Parliament not with the ability to make laws, but with the power to dissolve Parliament if it gets into an impossible situation or becomes corrupt. The Crown also has the power to reserve judgment on the laws agreed to by both houses in the Parliament. This three-tiered system of an upper house, a lower house, and a crown can be found in the Canadian Parliament, the British Parliament, and all the Australian states except Queensland. Queensland lost its upper house in 1922 by a sudden move in which the people were never consulted. The idea of a three-part parliament is known as the Trinitarian concept of government. And where it has been allowed to work under the correct principles, it has given us a greater degree of freedom than any other civilization has ever enjoyed. In the days when the Crown believed it had divinely ordained power, or at periods when politicians were able to flout checks and balances so that they in turn exercised sovereignty, there was a rapid retreat from freedom. It is worth looking more closely at those who are seeking more power for themselves. To consider the system another way, I want you to consider two enemies going for a walk. Each has a chain tethered to the collar of a leopard, which walks between them. Each can easily eliminate the other, simply by letting go of the chain. But he knows that he would soon become meal number two. And in an age of absolute power, monarchy was largely acclaimed because it was overt and it offered continuity. Everybody knew who the king was and who his successor was. It stopped a lot of literally bloody arguments. It also established accountability. If something was wrong in a state and nothing was being done, then everybody knew who was to blame. It was the king, and there was no question about it. It is not nearly so easy when the corruption of Parliament by political parties has moved the real decision-making process out of public view, out of sight, into the smoke-filled rooms of power brokers, numbers men, party whips and political henchmen. However, with an absolute monarch, while it was easy to know who to blame, it was not so easy to do anything about it. From a purely practical point of view, the greatest role of the monarchy is now a negative one. It retains two ultimate powers to itself. These are the command of the armed forces and the power to summon and dismiss governments. These ultimate powers do not belong to ambitious politicians. While Hitler was clever enough to have himself elected, such a man under a constitutional monarchy would still be in checkmate. If he acted unconstitutionally, he would be dismissed. It's as simple as that. In fact, Germany's monarchy had been abolished shortly before he came to power. No sooner did Hitler become the Führer than he destroyed Germany's constitution and abolished the upper house, which was not restored until after the destruction of the Third Reich. One Australian state premier was dismissed by the Queen's representative, the state governor, for deliberately acting unconstitutionally. A lot more have stayed in line with the People's Commission, the Constitution, for fear of a similar fate. After all, the only rule which defines and limits the politician's power is the Constitution. The reserve powers of the Crown are a sanction to contain the politicians within these rules. Now, imagine the monarch and the subjects of that monarch walking through history together. Between them stalks the hungry leopard. In the monarch's hands are golden chains called reserve powers, and in the people's hands a stout iron chain called elections. All that is left to complete the picture is the politician, filled with animal cunning and an insatiable lust for power, but being firmly held at the throat, the politician is all smiles and greetings, pretending that he is only taking the walk for the sunshine. There is one further responsibility, perhaps the most important of all, which once rested with the Crown, that of making and accepting the responsibility for coining and printing the nation's money. A reminder of this is the Crown's head, which we still see on some of our notes and coins. The power to create a nation's money system is the most powerful in existence. Over 90% of the nation's money is no longer made by the Crown, but has been ceded to a small but incredibly powerful club of bankers, who have, between them, managed to get the whole world into debt. We will look at this aspect in more detail later on. Thus it can be seen that right through our history, our system of government has not evolved in a haphazard way, but has been built on principle and precept. And while we observed those principles, our freedom expanded. When we have, in our history, deviated from them, or lost the knowledge of what these principles are, we have rapidly lost our freedoms, the freedom it took so many hundreds of years for our forefathers to develop.